All right, welcome to America This Week. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Walter Kern.
Walter, what's going on? Any up-in-the-air, real-world adventures that you have to share with us?
Well, now that you mention it, since the last show, I've been to New York City and back from Montana.
Did you see the eclipse, by the way?
Yeah, I saw it from Times Square, dude. It was like a UFO movie, you know, how you greet the aliens from places like Times Square and the National Mall. Well, I was in Times Square with the most diverse crowd of UFO viewers, probably in the United States, and one of the most massive, eclipse viewers, excuse me. And I seemed to be maybe one out of 1,000 people who was actually in my Midwestern way willing to buy eclipse glasses. So if I break out in a deadly eye infection, it's because I had to lend my eclipse glasses to maybe 800 strangers.
Why would you not buy eclipse glasses? That's not something I understand.
Somebody said, I forgot. And I was like, you forgot? This is the best publicized eclipse in the history of mankind. They've been talking about it for 7 months, and you forgot to buy glasses. But anyway, I was very liberal in my lending my own pair. People used them. They held them over their camera lenses so they could take pictures of the eclipse.
That doesn't really work.
Yeah. I mean, they barely got back to me after, 40 minutes of standing there. They finally cycled back to me, and I was able to see it. But I did see it, and it was only 85% in New York City, but I think 85% is enough. Who needs total eclipses? It's when you first see that big chunk coming out of it that I think you get the real spooky feeling. And after that, it's just a kind of progression. But it's that startlement that comes of knowing that the sun can be eclipsed.
Right. Yeah. No, it was a good one. I've only seen two. One I actually somehow didn't know was coming, and so when everything went dark, I was really surprised. I was about 24. This one was pretty cool. I was in New Jersey. I would say we got a little bit, it seemed like a little bit more than 85%. It was almost total, but it was cool. Very cool.
Well, it was weird in Manhattan too, because there were skyscrapers involved. Okay. So the sun kept moving as it traveled west, behind skyscrapers. So you would have to move, the crowd would have to move east to see sort of behind, get an angle up behind the skyscraper.
What you needed was the Green Goblin to come screaming around the corner and just start throwing
They had helicopters up, and they had these strange black Suburbans with complicated satellite and microwave equipment. I don't know what they were expecting, but it started to get kind of creepy in the last half hour before it started, because so much equipment had been moved in. And I was going on the Greg Gutfeld show that night. So I was near the base of Fox News near Rockefeller Center. And they had a set put up outside the building for live eclipse viewing. And it was their weather team that they assigned to the eclipse, which I found interesting. I mean, you don't expect them to have an astronomy team. Weather is, to me, something that occurs on Earth, not, far, far out in the vacuum of space, where there actually, by definition, is no weather.
Tides, right?
Yeah, are tides weather? I guess maybe it's unclear what weather it really is, actually. But somehow the eclipse didn't seem like it was weather to me,
right?
But weather reporting is its own special genre, and
I love it.
Yeah, exactly. Getting excited about things that have no real human content. Disaster weather is different when you're standing chest deep in a hurricane surge or something. But this kind of weather, which is just a mathematical progression of one lunar object over a solar object, making that into a kind of colorful thing is a real skill. Not sure they managed it.
It's people, but it's in keeping with you know, we had an earthquake, then we had an eclipse, so we need another sort of large scale natural event next week, and right. we'll know we're heading toward the apocalypse. So stuff happened this week, but probably the most interesting thing, and the thing that we can probably have the most interesting dialogue about, was actually a story about a media company. Mm-hmm. A couple of days ago, I don't know if this happened to you, my phone suddenly blew up with texts from politicians, other journalists, all sorts of people who normally I'd be talking to about real news stories, but the subject was NPR. And it was because the Barry Weiss's Free Press had an article by a fellow named Yuri Berliner, and we'll just show let's show the actual screen here. And he's now being described as a whistleblower, by the way, which is interesting. I don't know. Do you think whistleblower applies? I'm not really sure if that's the case. Maybe it is, because they'll want to fire him probably. But anyway, the headline is, "I've been at NPR for 25 years. Here's how we lost America's trust." And he has a lead that's very provocative. You know, the stereotype of the NPR listener, an EV driving, Wordle playing, tote bag carrying coastal elite. It doesn't particularly describe me, but it's not far off. I'm Sarah Lawrence, educated, was raised by a lesbian peace activist mother. I drive a Subaru, and Spotify says my listening habits are most similar to people in Berkeley. So this is the person who's been driven too far by working at NPR. And he talks about how the NPR's always had a liberal bent, but in recent years, it's changed. You know, we were nerdy, but not scolding. Today, those who listen to NPR or read its coverage find something different: the distilled worldview of a very small segment of the U.S. population. An open-minded spirit no longer exists within NPR, and now, predictably, we don't have an audience that reflects America. This talks about how there's been this dramatic shift in its listenership. So, in 2011. 26% described them as conservative, 23% is middle of the road, and 37% is liberal. Now it's 67% liberal, 21% middle of the road, and 11% said very or somewhat conservative.
I always wonder about those people. How could 11% of people think NPR is conservative?
These are the listeners.
No, I know, but how could 11% of NPR's listeners think that it's a conservative broadcast?
Well, no, they're describing themselves.
Okay, I see.
But there's an equally pertinent question, which is how could conservatives listen to the station? Right. Maybe they hate listen to it. I mean, that's the sort of Howard Stern model of media.
Tell you what, something that people don't realize about NPR is for those who, like me, sometimes live in the country, way out in the country, the NPR signal and the NPR broadcasts are the only news you can get.
That is true. That is true. And if you've ever had to drive across country for work, you know that your choices are often narrowed to a gospel station or NPR.
Right.
Right. But then he went on and did two things that I think were really interesting. He said that he cited specific examples of areas where the station had made a mistake. One was putting Adam Schiff on the air too many times during the Russiagate thing. And this paragraph right here is, I think, pretty significant. I should have highlighted it before. It's one thing to swing and miss on a major story. Unfortunately, it happens. You follow the wrong leads. But then he says, what's worse is to pretend it never happened, to move on with no mea culpas, no self-reflection. I mean, that's a big thing to say. Mm-hmm. And then he goes on to say it happened also with the Hunter Biden story and so on and so on. And there was a great gnashing of teeth after this came out, and we can talk about the response to this. But Walter, what did you think first when you read this? It was a significant thing to come from someone who ostensibly, I guess, is still employed there.
First of all, I think it's a misnomer to call him a whistleblower. A whistleblower reveals something that's secret. None of this is secret, especially. what did I think? Well, I used to be an avid NPR listener, mostly because I lived on a farm way out of town, and it was the strongest signal, and it was the only source for news and discussion. AM radio has talk radio, call-in shows, so on, but those are of limited use in trying to understand stories for the first time. Get your news. You might listen to them to hear it analyzed or opinion or opined about. Anyway, I stopped listening to NPR many years ago, and for a very simple reason. It got incredibly repetitive and incredibly boring and incredibly smug and almost unlistenable, frankly. The parts of it, there was back when car talk and, various jazz or classical music shows and so on. But the current events segments were unendurable for me. Not because I disagreed with them, but because they were just so monotonous. And they were, and like anything that goes on too long and becomes too comfortable with itself, they became self-parodic. And once the hilarity of the self-parody had worn off, it was just exhausting. It took a lot, though, to chase me off from NPR, because let me tell you, I was positively disposed. Not only did I like the fact that they broadcast clearly into the country, but I'd grown up in Minnesota. I've probably mentioned this before. I knew Garrison Keillor a little when I was a kid, and I lived in one of the towns that was basis for Lake Wobegon. And my mom lived next door to an NPR producer and an NPR personality in a little town called Marine, Minnesota. Minnesota Public Radio is a producer of a lot of content for the national public radio. In those days, not just Prairie Home Companion, but a music show called From the Top, I believe, and a cooking show, and so on. And I, as a writer, had used NPR's hyper-literate audience many times to publicize my books, and was quite grateful that they would do these long-form interviews with me and other authors. I benefited from that many times, and the interviews were and the interviews were often great, really well prepared and searching and thoughtful. So for me to stop listening to NPR was not an easy thing. But when they started injecting their pet obsessions into every single story, much like I just said about the weather, weather was always about race, suddenly. So was sports. So was everything. And they had this like new form of story in which they could take a pretty interesting story and then turn it upside down and balance it on its tip, and using the subjects of race, social justice, and so on. And it wasn't that it just all became such an editorial trick that one got tired of it. It became a kind of rant, as though I needed constant edification from them. Like, you made your point yesterday and the day before and the day before. I know
it's 2 minutes ago.
Yeah, and 2 minutes ago. And this is becoming a kind of like a re-education program or something. Don't worry, I understand. Some of it I agree with, but no one who listens to NPR is just few who are doing it for the first time. You don't have to keep converting me to your insular enlightened point of view, you can just talk about things. And when they stopped doing that, I just couldn't bear it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it was like the sayings of Angkor in Cambodia, just blasted out over and over again. You know, the same message constantly, and again, I totally agree with you. I'm an author like you. I had to go on NPR and massively benefited from the long form interviews that I used to do on those stations, not just for the national shows, but regionally. Mm-hmm. And they were always incredibly well prepared and really got to the heart of the matter. I mean, one of my favorites was Leonard Lopate here in New York. In the New York area, and he is, you know, he actually read the book, and you know, he would do these very, very elaborate interviews that were challenging. I mean, he would push you on certain points, and but he would do it quickly, and there wouldn't be any wasted time at all. And mm-hmm. I thought this is really professionally well done, you know, and it was a real help. But then they just sort of almost overnight turned into this other thing. And now what Berliner is describing is this thing that started to be whispered about in newsrooms, I would say sometime between, I don't know if this is your experience, sometime between 2015 and, you know, the end of the Trump years, the Trump presidency, this idea that we, you know, newsrooms are not diversified enough, so we have to change the composition of the newsroom. And there were, and I know of several other places where this exact debate that he's describing took place. He's saying that yes, they made a great effort to try to bring in more minorities and to have more stories that were about identity issues on the air, but they narrowed the viewpoint diversity on the channel. And I know there were other newsrooms, particularly in 2020, that were having this exact debate. For instance, you know, there's one site I know of where they were having a question of, shouldn't we have more veterans on the air? It's not just about, you know, having more conservatives. It's, should we have more people who are not from the upper classes? Should we have more people who've served in the military? Should we have more of this and this and this? And the answer was always no. Let's opt for this other sort of diversity. And that's why it's so fascinating to look at the response after this story came out. NPR published its own response. The author was David Folkenfick, and let's just take a quick look at some of these quotes because they're kind of amazing, and I think speak to, you know, the degree to which they were not understanding the point. So headline: NPR defends its journalism after senior editor says it has lost the public's trust. Now remember, this is going on alongside a major decline in audience share, which is, I think, is pretty much always your fault as a reporter. But whatever, they do this story, and there are some amazing quotes in here. The supervising editor for digital news says, as a person of color who's often worked in newsrooms with little to no people who look like me, the efforts NPR has made to diversify its workforce and its sources are unique and appropriate given the news industry's long-standing lack of diversity. Now, there's some truth in that. So let's just keep that in mind for a minute. Then he says, I never criticized NPR's Berliner replies, I never criticized NPR's priority of achieving a more diverse workforce in terms of race, ethnicity, and sexual orientation. I have not denigrated its diversity goals. That's wrong. He's talking about something else. Then they put in this quote from the NPR ombudsman that I thought was really interesting. I know Yuri, he's not wrong. That's a pretty strong thing to say in the middle of all this. Then there's this one that you and I both noticed. Others question Berliner's logic. This probably gets causality backward, tweeted Semaphore Washington editor Jordan Weissman. I'd guess that a lot of NPR listeners who voted for Mitt Romney have changed how they identify politically. Walter, what do they mean by that?
They're suggesting that the right side of the spectrum has become extremist and somehow migrated so far to the MAGA side or whatever that they're no longer interested in middle of the road content, that the Romneyites became Trumpites, that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the we who did it, it was our audience. Our audience is no longer worthy of it. Well, first of all, their job is not to be pure at NPR, okay? I'm sorry. By this logic, NPR will be broadcasting someday to three people who believe the right things. And their job is to be the national public radio station. And if America has moved in its beliefs, even stipulating that they are right with this, then they should address that. I'm afraid their desire to be better than their own country may leave them in a very lonely phone booth someday, you know, with three ideologically perfect broadcasters broadcasting to one perfect listener. So blaming the audience for getting stupid or bigoted or whatever it might be, it isn't going to work. Also, this, you know, though I just went through my problem with NPR, that didn't really represent what Berliner was saying. Berliner was saying, we've gotten three of the biggest stories of the last few years wrong, and wrong in the same way. First, we got Russiagate wrong. We relied on Adam Schiff, and then when Mueller came out and didn't find anything, we just sort of drifted away and were like, oh, look, birds over there. We never addressed that failure. Then he's saying we got COVID wrong. We went all in on this, you know, the lab leak idea is ridiculous and we made fun of it and we shot it down and we really went with the establishment and we hitched our horse to what turns out to be a very partisan specific and maybe and probably erroneous narrative.
Right.
And then I'm not sure what the other.
The Hunter Biden story example. Was the third one.
And the Hunter Biden story that we proclaimed fulsomely that we were not going to address something that wasn't news, you know, before the election. This wasn't newsy enough for us. And so we're not even going to report on it. And he says, well, actually, what the Hunter Biden laptop revealed was newsworthy. It was a network of influence and, maybe corruption scandals that were exactly what we should be reporting on, and we just blew it off.
Right.
So, trying to switch this and make it about diversity in the response really doesn't cover his critique. He's not drawing a correspondence between the newsroom diversity in terms of race and so on and their coverage. Maybe he's suggesting that there might be a relationship, but his critique is of the product, not the producers. But ultimately, he does say in the Berliner, you know, I did a poll of 87 people who work in the Washington headquarters, seeing who was a Republican, who was a Democrat, and the score was 87 Democrats to zero Republicans. And he suggested that maybe that doesn't represent diversity, despite it being their, quote, North Star, and doesn't represent inclusion in a meaningful fashion. But as I was going to say, the NPR response in this Folk and Flick article doesn't really get to why they got all these stories wrong. It switches the topic.
It's funny because that's part of his criticism is we didn't address it and they still didn't address it.
They blamed the audience. This one guy, the Washington editor, blamed the audience. Well, you know, they abandoned us. The sensible Romneyites who became raving MAGA creeps. What are we supposed to do about that? Then other people just reiterated how important inclusion is, and nobody really questioned that. They only questioned it insofar as it may be related to this editorial failure that this guy, because remember, this is radio. The listener can't see the composition of your newsroom, okay? Like, I can't tell what gender and racial and other distribution you have there. I can only hear what comes out of that speaker. And people don't like listening to what comes out of that speaker in large numbers anymore. So,
okay, now that's the key point, because, you know, this whole idea that our audience is failing us because they've moved so far to the right, I think is totally erroneous. And again, like, here's one of their responses. You know, the philosophy is, do you want us to serve all of America and make sure it sounds like all of America or not? I'd welcome the argument against that. Well, Berliner just made the argument against that, and you didn't respond to that.
But they're talking about two different things. They're comparing apples and oranges. The one guy says diversity means, including employees from all these different racial and other categories. And the other guy says, I'm talking about diversity of viewpoint and, not just opinion, but sort of story selection and so on. And point of view in stories. So they're talking past each other.
Yeah, and he goes on to say, on radio, we were really lagging in our representation of audience that makes us look like what America looks like today, but then that they fixed it, and so on and so forth. I think what they don't understand is that that this is exactly what's so offensive and hard to take about NPR, is that they think that they're doing stories that American minorities want to hear. Like these stories will be of interest to Black Americans. These stories will be of interest to Hispanic Americans. These stories will be of interest to Asian Americans. But what they actually are caricatures of somebody's idea of what's interesting to those to those audiences, and they may appeal to a niche segment of kind of upper class people, but they're not appealing to the sort of broad mean of America, right? Like, and we're going to get to the kinds of stories that they've done over the years.
Well, the great irony of Berliner's piece was he said our listenership in Black and Hispanic terms has decreased, despite this huge initiative that we see around the office and talk about in our meetings. We've got fewer Black listeners. We've got fewer Hispanic listeners. This is the paradox of white saviorism. Let's imagine that the old NPR, which felt it was insufficiently diverse, was basically run by white people. So then white people went out and chose the minority people that they thought would diversify it. So these are white people's idea of what Black people are.
Right. Exactly.
They do the picking. So in a way, they reify their own prejudices in the personnel choices they make, and then they think they've finished the job. We picked the kind of people from other races that we think represent those races. These are white people's idea of representative minorities. We brought them in, and now we all agree about everything because basically we forced the card, as it were. You know, we picked people who already fit our categories. And why isn't everybody happy out there?
Right. It's their fault.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, so rather than fixing a problem, you're actually sort of doubling or tripling it when you do what they did. You know, NPR had, you know, I think it had a lot of broad appeal. It probably didn't pay enough attention to certain issues once upon a time, and they were probably correct.